You're tuned to Perspectives, the weekly public affairs show, which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sines, your host for Perspectives, and joining us today is Dr. Don Moss. Dr. Moss is a psychology professor, also the author of the recent book, Alzheimer's, My Journey to a Next Generation Treatment. Dr. Moss, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Well, thank you for having me, Louis. It's my pleasure.
Now, before I start, I want to talk a little bit about your book, and I went online and read some of the reviews, and here's one by Linda Collison, and she read the Kindle edition, which a lot of people are reading ebooks now, and she says, "Is Alzheimer's the new cancer? The very word certainly cast the fearful shadow the word cancer once cast. Alzheimer's, My Journey to a Next Generation is a professional memoir about one man's quest to make available a simple drug proven to be highly effective in treating the symptoms of Alzheimer's dementia. A better drug with far fewer unpleasant side effects than brand name drugs currently prescribe." And some people say, well, if that's the case, that should be pretty easy to say, hey, we found this, let's go for it. But that's not as easy as people may think, as you found out.
That's absolutely right. It's a very long road between discovering a drug that should work. Theoretically, you think it will work and it has all these nice characteristics. And then it's a long road to get it through animal testing and actually get it into humans and prove that it does, in fact, work. And I was lucky enough that we did that. I got to run a human clinical trial on this drug, and I'll call it MSF. It stands for methane sulfonyl fluoride. It's a very simple drug. But I had an opportunity in 1995 and 1996 to actually try it in humans. And it was relatively free of the side effects that plagued the other drugs. And it showed great response in the humans, in the real patients. It produced more than twice the improvement that is reported for the old-style drugs that are still in use right now.
Now, the old-style drugs that, as you mentioned, are still in use, those drugs bring in billions, and I'm probably maybe even underestimating dollars, to insurance companies, pharmaceutical people, et cetera. But what they do is something that your drug would actually help the patient, because basically what these drugs do is they just treat the acetylcholine?
Yeah, the drugs that are currently available are designed to boost acetylcholine in the brain. And we know very well that it's a hallmark of Alzheimer's disease that the brain loses the ability to make acetylcholine. And my drug, MSF, is also designed to boost acetylcholine in the brain. But my drug does it by a mechanism that's more innovative and unique, and it makes it selective for the brain. So we can boost memory in the brain because of the brain function without boosting acetylcholine function in the rest of the body. And it's the effect of these drugs in the rest of the body, particularly in the gastrointestinal tract, that cause the unpleasant side effects of nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea that prevent the patients from taking the old-style drugs in high enough doses to really make a difference. But MSF is not a drug that stops the progression of the disease. It will boost cognitive functioning and memory, and it will keep patients out of nursing homes and out of assisted living longer, keeps them at home, living with their family, better quality of life for perhaps 2 or 3 years longer. And that could save an awful lot of money for Medicare and other payers, insurance companies.
You mentioned as far as the old drugs and the acetylcholine and the fact that what it does is it tells our muscles, I guess, when to cramp. But these new drugs, they keep producing that, correct? And they keep making you do that, and that's why it causes the diarrhea, the nausea, the vomiting. And your drug kind of lowers that and
yes.
stops that?
Yes, my
puts
drug,
a halt to it?
Yeah, my drug being selective for the brain reduces the risk of nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and cramps. And the way the old-style drugs deal with the side effect in the bowels is they limit the dose. to what the patient can tolerate in their gastrointestinal system. And unfortunately, that's not a dose that is really effective at boosting memory. The old-style drugs could be a lot more effective if the patients could tolerate them at a higher dose, but they just can't do it because of the gastrointestinal problems. My drug avoids the gastrointestinal problems.
It's interesting what you mentioned about the dosage, because in your book, it talks about when you were working at a clinic in Chihuahua and you were figuring out the dose of an untested medicine, and you said, figuring out the dose of an untested medicine is dicey. If I didn't give enough, it wouldn't work. If I gave too much, it could be toxic. And people don't realize when you're talking about not enough and too little, you're talking about very, very quantities that need to be measured accurately.
Yes, they have to be measured very accurately. The adequate dose for this drug, if it was taken on a daily basis, is 77 micrograms. That is 77 millionths of a gram per kilogram of body weight, which means that it has to be weighed out in the very tiniest amounts, and it has to be weighed out accurately. If you make a mistake, of course, it won't do any good. If you err on the side of being too low, or if you err on the side of being too high, then, of course, the patient can have a toxic reaction.
You talk at the beginning when you were doing work with your brother, and the fact that you all did some lab work, and then it turns out that the results were quite different from your, I guess, graduate advisor or your chair.
Yeah.
And you were thinking, wait a minute, he couldn't have made these mistakes, but you figured out that something had gone wrong.
Well, I guess as a graduate student,
or right.
you should always read your graduate advisor's papers before you start experiments. But we did not. And we found that this sulfonyl fluoride, which is a cousin to the drug that I finally wound up with, but the sulfonyl fluoride that we were working with showed that it would react very quickly with brain acetylcholinesterase. And our graduate advisor had found that it did not react. And what we did is a series of experiments to determine why that was true. And it turns out that it's a difference between species. Our graduate advisor used acetylcholinesterase from fish, and we were using it from mammal. But the key to that experiment was that we found that the sulfonyl fluoride reacted very quickly with mammalian brain acetylcholinesterase. And I should mention that acetylcholinesterase is the enzyme that breaks down acetylcholine in the brain in normal function. And in Alzheimer's disease, we don't have enough acetylcholine. So the therapeutic strategy is to stop the brain from breaking down the acetylcholine, let it accumulate, amplify the signal. And the way we do that is we look for an inhibitor of acetylcholinesterase. That experience that I had back in 1970, over 40 years ago now, with my brother, alerted me to the fact that the sulfonyl fluorides are very good at inhibiting acetylcholinesterase in the brain, and that's what I discovered later was needed to treat Alzheimer's disease.
So is this kind of like what cancer patients, breast cancer patients especially, are given sometimes as far as inhibitors for or receptors for producing estrogen?
In a way, it is. Probably a better model for this would be Parkinson's disease, and I think a lot of people may be familiar with Parkinson's disease. And in Parkinson's disease, the brain loses the ability to make dopamine. And in Parkinson's disease, you can trick the brain into making more dopamine by loading the person with L-DOPA. In Alzheimer's disease, the problem is the brain loses the ability to make acetylcholine, and acetylcholine is necessary for memory. We can't trick the brain into making more acetylcholine, but we can stop the brain from breaking it down as quickly so that it will hang around two or three times longer. The concentrations go up and we can restore normal function.
We've talked a little bit about your research in Colorado and then in San Diego. However, then you came to El Paso, you came to UT El Paso, you worked here and you were still working a little bit on that medication. But the problem is the fact that it's not easy to just go up to the FDA and say, look, I think I have a solution, and can you sponsor me, and getting that grant money and all that stuff. What is the procedure, Don?
Well, this drug fell through the cracks, and I like to say that it was born outside of the wedlock of big money and big pharma. In order to get the FDA approval, it will cost somewhere in the range of perhaps up to $200 million, maybe $300 million. And in some cases, when drugs have trouble, it might cost $500 million or $500 million to get it approved for use. And the problem with this drug is that I really identified a drug that already existed, and so it wasn't my drug. I identified a chemical that already existed. It was not patentable. The drug itself was not patentable. And then patent attorney and I worked together to screw up the first opportunity we had to maybe get a use patent. So we had no patent protection. And unless you have patent protection so that you know that if you go through this long and torturous problem with the FDA and spend $200 or $300 million, that you have to be able to recover it. You have to have the patent protection so that you know that you're going to be the only one that can offer the drug for a period of several years. If you don't have that protection, as soon as it's approved by the FDA and you don't have a patent, then a generic drug company can come in and they can produce it for pennies compared to what the originating drug company had to spend, and they can undersell it and you lose all that money. It's just not a good business model, and the stockholders of a company won't let a company take over a drug without patent protection.
You did not give up. You continued fighting, looking for ways to do it, and I'm not sure if it happened before or after, but was 94 the breakthrough year? Is that when they asked you to go to Mexico?
Yes. 94, 95, and 96 were pivotal years. And because I live and work here in El Paso, I'm familiar with Mexico, and we had the opportunity to work in Mexico that would have never developed in any other place. I mean, if I'd have taken a job in Michigan or Iowa or wherever, I wouldn't have ever thought of going to Mexico. But I met a colleague in Chihuahua, Ciudad Chihuahua, Dr. Patricia Berlanga, who offered to work with me and test the drug in patients. And we did that test down there for $500,000. I'm sorry, not $500,000. We did it for $50,000. And we did it with a grant from the Coldwell Foundation here in El Paso. I'd accumulated $50,000. And so you can see the difference between doing it in the United States and doing it in Mexico. And because it worked very successfully in Mexico and we got a great response in the patients, then it made it possible for us to get a patent on it. And we got a patent in 1998. But I worked in Mexico and mainly in 95 and 96. And it was a great experience.
And at what point did you decide to write this book, Alzheimer's, My Journey to a Next Generation Treatment?
Well, I decided to write this book about my journey bringing MSF to patients when I thought that there was no possibility that it would ever be developed as a drug. I wrote it out of frustration. And the reason that things looked bad and I decided to write the book is that the patent that we got in 1998 is only for 17 years. So it's going to be up in 2015. And there was a Swiss company that was working on MSF and they had licensed it and it was their intention to get FDA approval. And they invested millions of dollars in 3 years moving it forward. They did lots of preclinical testing in animals for toxicity and all the things that are required by the FDA. And they got FDA approval, and they also got the equivalent of FDA approval in Germany or in Europe. And they actually ran a phase one human clinical trial in Germany. That's a trial where they look for safety in humans. Now, I had run a phase one trial for safety in Mexico and a phase two trial looking at efficacy, whether it actually worked and reduced dementia or not in Mexico. But this was an opportunity to have an FDA compliant phase one trial, and it replicated what I found in Mexico. The results were very successful. But the Swiss company decided to give it up because the patent is expiring in 2015. So I decided I better write a book. Maybe out of all this work, maybe I could get an interesting book.
What's the next step?
Well, the book has triggered a lot of interest in the drug, and it was read by a colleague of mine in Oregon. And he runs a drug company. He runs a chemical company. He manufactures research reagents, but his long-term goal is to treat cancer. And he read the book, and he decided, well, let's do this. Let's pursue the development of this drug through the Orphan Product Program, which in the United States is a program that does not depend upon having a patent. It's to foster the development of drugs that would fail otherwise because of financial reasons. And I need to point out that the reason that MSF is failing is not because it doesn't work. I mean, it works very well in patients. The only reason that it's failing in the development is that it does not have a patent and the finances aren't there for that. So we're going to pursue this under the Orphan Drug Program, and we're going to be looking for philanthropic sources of money. We're going to be looking for people who care more about Alzheimer's disease maybe than making money. And if people have small amounts of money to contribute to the cause, we'll use it to bring it forward. If we're successful at the end of this thing, because we won't be owing money to stockholders or venture capitalists, we expect to be able to offer MSF to patients for $1 to $2 a day. And that's way below most drug costs.
I would imagine, Dr. Mawson, and some people have mentioned this in some of the articles I've read, not particularly about your book, but about other things, the fact that when something like that comes along, whether it be medication, whether it be gasoline, whether it be whatever, that if it's going to halt somebody's profit, they're going to step in and say, wait a minute, there's something wrong with this, so they're going to try and put a stop to it. Because at $2 a pill or $2 a day, insurance companies are going to say, we're not going to make any money off of this, or pharmaceutical companies.
Well, but on the other hand, the insurance companies have a choice of either paying for people to be in nursing homes and suffering from severe dementia, requiring a lot of care, or the person can take a medication that will rehabilitate their ability to take care of themselves, live independently for 2 or 3 years, perhaps longer. And so in the long run, they may look at this and say, this drug will save us a lot of money. Now, I expect that we will get a lot of heat from big drug companies that have the other old-style drugs. One of them is Exelon, and another one is Aricept, and they're owned by Novartis and Pfizer, and those are big drug companies. They may not be very happy with us, but I guess that's the nature of the market forces.
As far as the research that you did in Mexico, when you concluded that research, did you determine at the end of those studies that the drug indeed did work? And if so, people may be wondering, why did you not market it in Mexico? Is it because you wanted it here in the United States, or is it different? How does the patent system work in Mexico?
Well, that's a very good question. I suspect that we could have gotten it approved in Mexico for a lot less than we would get it approved for in the United States. But still, we didn't have the resources to go forward. I didn't have the resources to pursue the required testing even in Mexico. And I did not look for investors, but investors are always going to be balancing how much is it going to cost to develop the drug versus how much can we make on it in use in the clinical population. And that maybe is a direction that I should have gone, but I didn't go that direction.
As far as what the reviewer wrote in at the beginning when I said that Alzheimer's is the new cancer, would you agree with that?
It's not a very good analogy. It is a serious health problem. 20% of us are going to have Alzheimer's disease during our life. Our whole life risk is 20%. And for every patient that has Alzheimer's disease, it involves about three people to take care of them. So it really affects a lot of people. But Alzheimer's disease is different from cancer in a way, and that is, in cancer, it's the fear is pain and deterioration, physical deterioration, and there are 60 or 70 different kinds of cancer, and it's really hard to treat all of those. With Alzheimer's, it's got a special fear factor, and that is that we lose the ability to think and to take care of ourselves, and that's really frightening to people. But also, Alzheimer's disease seems to be, in my opinion, a unitary disease process. That is, once it starts, it's pretty much one disease process, and all patients go through a certain sequence of, well, with some variation, but they go through a certain sequence of things. Now, Alzheimer's might be triggered by several different things. It might be triggered by genetics. We know that there are some genetic variations that make people more at risk for Alzheimer's. And head trauma clearly plays a role in increasing the risk of Alzheimer's or Alzheimer's-like dementia. Other things may trigger it, but it's different from cancer in that it's just one disease process.
You mentioned early onset and then also early dementia. Are those the same or are they different?
Early onset Alzheimer's disease is a dementia that starts before age 65. And Alzheimer's disease is very hard to diagnose clinically. And anybody that thinks that they might have Alzheimer's disease should go see a neurologist or a psychiatrist that specializes in dementia and be checked out. Hopefully, they have some other disease that can be treated. But Alzheimer's makes up about two-thirds of the dementia. Dementia in general is just a loss of the ability to think and the loss of memory. So dementia is kind of a general term. Alzheimer's is a fairly specific term, and we try to use clinical diagnoses for that. And that is after we rule out other sources of dementia, such as vitamin B12 deficiency or brain tumors or normal pressure hydrocephalus or other diseases of the brain such as encephalitis or syphilis or brain injury, those kinds of things. And we want to rule out the multiple infarct dementia, which is a dementia syndrome that follows a series of really small strokes. After we rule out all of those things, then you might come down and say, okay, you probably have Alzheimer's disease. You won't know for sure until the brain goes to autopsy, and most people don't have an autopsy. But early onset Alzheimer's disease is a dementing illness that starts before age 65 and meets the clinical criteria for having Alzheimer's, that is ruling out all of these other things. And there are some clear genetic modifications that predispose people to have the early onset type of disease.
It
varies from family to family, some of them, but if you have early onset in your family, other people in your family are at risk for it. You'll have a greater incidence than the general population. But I hasten to add that when you have early onset Alzheimer's disease, the genetic relationship is not strong enough for people to be certain that they're going to get the disease or something. They should go talk to a neurologist and get an assessment.
What are some of the symptoms that people, because, you know, a lot of people forget things.
Yes.
Sometimes we'll say, like myself, well, I'm just getting older or I'll have short-term memory, forget something. And so at what point do you decide, I better go get checked?
Well, the first thing that happens in Alzheimer's disease in almost all cases is people find that they have sort of a tragic loss of memory. And by that, I mean it's much more serious than you forget where you park your car. I mean, I do that all the time, and my memory defect is not progressive. But if you not only forget where you park your car all the time, but then when you get in your car, you can't remember how to get home, or you begin to have some difficulty getting around, getting lost is one of the first things, then it's a sign that you should go get checked out. And you really must get checked out because some dementing illnesses are treatable. And the earlier, the better. Alzheimer's right now is not really treatable. I mean, we have the drugs to enhance memory, but we can't stop the progression of the disease. We cannot prevent it right now.
Now, let's say MSF is approved. At what point do you start prescribing that?
Well, MSF was very effective, I should say, in an animal experiment that showed that 2-year-old rats who have very bad memory spontaneously. I mean, it's just an age-related memory impairment. It made them perform as well as young rats. So if it's approved, it might have indications for more than Alzheimer's disease. Any kind of mild cognitive impairment, any kind of beginning serious memory impairment, light dementia, you could start taking it. And it should also be useful up through moderate to even fairly severe dementia. There would be a difference in the dose that you would have to take, but it should be useful.
As far as progression, does that depend on the patient?
Well, if it progresses that rapidly, it's probably not Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's is a fairly slow progression, usually from the onset of memory problems until death is 7 to 8 years. And people need to remember that Alzheimer's disease is a fatal progressive disease. That is, you will die of Alzheimer's if you don't die of something else first. But the rate of progression varies quite a lot. A very fast rate of Alzheimer's disease might be 4 years between the onset of memory problems and death, or 5 years. And it could go as long as 20 or more years. There are some dementing disorders that go much more rapidly than Alzheimer's disease. And if somebody changed quickly over a period of months or a year.
There have been stories of people who have been in accidents and were, you know, they forget who they are. They forget their identity for months at a time sometimes. Does that mean that the brain has stopped producing acetylcholine?
You're talking about after a traumatic brain injury,
yes,
such as an automobile accident. And mm-hmm. You're also talking about then they recover their memory at
right.
The end. That's probably not a permanent change in the brain's ability to make acetylcholine. It's probably not actually killing those neurons, which is what happens in Alzheimer's disease. What is happening is that there are neurons in the brain that are injured, and it takes a while for them to repair themselves. And they may or may not be neurons that use acetylcholine specifically. They may use acetylcholine, but I suspect it's a more generalized injury to the brain in that case.
Can you reapply for a patent, or do you have to get this approved before 2015?
No, we cannot get it renewed. The patent is going to be over and done, final. And no, we don't have to do it before 2015 because the orphan product program is independent of the patent. If we get through the orphan product program, we will have 7 years of market exclusivity. The FDA will give us 7 years instead of 17 years. And I should also mention that if people want to know more about the development of MSF, they could go to a website that we have, and it's called braintools.com, BRAIN-TOOLS.com. And they can get more information about MSF on that website.
We've been visiting with Dr. Donald Moss, a psychology professor and also the author of Alzheimer's, My Journey to a Next Generation Treatment. Dr. Moss, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thank you, Louis. It's my pleasure.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Elvin Alves. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sainz.